Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached our cruising altitude of 30,000 feet and will begin our beverage service shortly. Until then, it's time for a little Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com. All right, all right. Hi there. I'm Amelia Dalton, and yes, indeed, we are taking to the skies this week. What could be better for our climb up to flight level 300? Better fuel, of course, so we can go farther and faster, right? Well, a team at Duke University is working on a project that could not only reduce growing levels of CO2 in our atmosphere, and could also lead to the development of alternative energies, all without the creation of those awful byproducts like carbon monoxide. How exactly? At the center of this research is a study of plasmonics, which involves adding light to energize metallic nanoparticles. You see, plasmonic metal nanoparticles act kind of like antennas that absorb visible and ultraviolet light. This antenna mechanism is incredibly efficient and can accomplish a number of different effects, including the generation of strong electric fields. At the center of this research at Duke University is an element by the name of rhodium. Now, we've known about rhodium for quite a while. Rhodium has already been used as a chemical catalyst in several different industries. It's used in the production of fertilizers, pharmaceuticals, detergents, and can even be found in catalytic converters and automotive exhaust systems. But the difference with this study is the addition of the light on the rhodium. Okay, so in previous studies, only heat was used to force the chemical reaction in the rhodium nanostructures. But these nanoparticles were illuminated with a high-powered ultraviolet LED, and the chemical reaction yielded almost exclusively methane. Instead of methane and carbon monoxide that the heat-only reaction caused. So, the possibility of it changing how we create fuel is close at hand. This team at Duke University are setting their sights on using sunlight with rhodium as a chemical catalyst on the nanoscale, in the hopes that a solar-powered reaction can be part of our renewable energy systems. So, if you want any further information about this plasmonic rhodium study, I've included a link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com that will take you directly to a super interesting article entitled Product Selectivity in Plasmonic Photocatalysis for Carbon Dioxide Hydrogenation. Phew, that was hard to say. All right, enough of this nanoparticle business. Let's head straight into the bright blue yonder with Michael Slanowski and Ivan Stresnicki from Curtis Wright. With a bogey on our tail, Michael, Ivan, and I are flying past the challenges of safety certifiable avionics and right into the heart of the next generation of airborne vehicles. Let's go. Hi, Mike and Ivan. Thank you so much for joining me today. So first, Mike, give my audience a quick recap on what Curtis Wright is all about.
Okay. Curtis Wright has been around for, over 75 years, involved in aerospace and mil-aero business. Today, we are pretty well a premier supplier of product into the mil-aero space, everything from single-board computers, Ethernet switches, graphics products, crash recorders, displays, you name it, and we probably provide that type of equipment into our product space, as well as all the major manufacturers and system integrators like BAE, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin's. All those are customers of many of our products, and we are one of their major suppliers in many areas of their business.
Okay, Mike, let's talk about designing avionics, and more specifically, designing safety-certifiable avionics. So what kind of challenges are you seeing in that design realm? And on the flip side, what kind of solutions are you also seeing to help solve these issues?
One thing you first of all have to understand from avionics, and specifically a safety cert type of avionics, is that within the design and product space there, more and more customers nowadays are looking for off-the-shelf solutions. Why? Because in designing avionics for a safety cert application, you basically have to look at the software side and the hardware side. From the hardware side, there's a specification from the RTCA called DO254, and that's the method that you should use in order to design safety certifiable product. And within both the hardware side and the software side, there are design levels of assurance, or DAL levels, and those go from a very low level, let's say E and D, all the way up to A, where A is the highest level of certification requirement. And so both on the hardware side and the software side, you basically have a set of requirements in order to follow to meet the expectations of a certification authority like ESA or the FAA in order to take that final product and certify it within the application that it's been designed for. Now, we have more and more customers that are looking for commercial off-the-shelf or COTS products in trying to design for their end applications because they're seeing their customers demanding a faster time to market. They're seeing their customers demand a little bit or a lot lower NRE in order to deliver that product, as well as there's a lot more requirements coming down the chute. And so what we're seeing is a lot of demand for commercial off-the-shelf COTS. Why? Again, because of the fact that they can't afford to design it all themselves anymore. And our prime integrators are looking for COTS products such that they can add their value from a system perspective, add their value from the application software that's running on top of the hardware and the software, and you know, rather than having to design everything and every little bit and piece. So what COTS does is we can provide them with the hardware, specifically from a single board computer perspective, I/O, graphics, all the things that go into making that system. We basically work with software partners like Green Hills Integrity, Wind River, LinuxWorks, DDCI, Cisco, in order to have them provide the software, the DO-178 type of software, 653, and then we provide the hardware and provide a full solution. Now, in providing that the hardware side, we also need to provide a set of artifacts. And those artifacts are things that the customer can take and combine with their set of documentation such that when they go to the certification authority, like the FAA or ESA, right, they basically have a complete set of documentation that shows that this system from the lowest components like single board computers, graphics modules, I/O modules, all the way up to the system and all the application software put on it meets the certification requirements for that specific system.
All right, so let's bring in Ivan for the next question. Ivan, since we met at the Embedded Tech Trends Conference recently in New Orleans, let's talk about OpenVPX. Now, where do you think we're headed for the next generation of OpenVPX?
Yes, hi, Amelia, and thanks for this opportunity. I think let's start with the background of VPX and OpenVPX. Back around 2005, when the VPX initiative and standardization was started, connector was chosen and vetted that was rated at 6.25 gigabaud or gigabits per second. And we really thought that that was going to be more than enough bandwidth and speed for the foreseeable future. Back then, the protocols and switch serial fabrics that were being used were the so-called Gen 1 protocols, so things like Gen 1 Serial Rapid I/O and PCI Express 1.0, which ran at about 2.5 to 3.125 gigabits per second. Gen 2 stepped that up to about 5 to 6.25 gigabits per second or gigabaud. That was, again, Gen 2 Serial Rapid I/O and PCI Express 2.0. That's where we hit roughly the advertised limit of the VPX connector system. Gen 3 came out 2 or 3 years ago at about 8 to 10.3 gigabits per second. Things like PCI Express 3.0 and the 40 gig, 10 gig KR Ethernet standards were the protocols for Gen 3. That's where things started to get a little bit hairy, but various vendors have been able to overcome the limitations of the connector system and have put products out into the ecosystem, including Curtiss-Wright with our Fabric 40 solution. Today, 2017, is when we expect the ratification of the next-gen PCI Express standard, which would be PCI Express 4.0, which steps the speeds all the way up to 16 gigabaud. At that point, things get really exciting and difficult at the same time and challenging, but with challenges come opportunities. We've recently announced with the right design rules that we've been able to use the standard VPX connector system at those speeds, at the PCI Express 4.0 speeds of 16 gigabaud, still continuing to use the standard VPX connector. So that's where we're at today. The next generation, or Gen 5, would likely be protocols like 100 gig KR Ethernet, which run at 25 gig speeds. At that point, we're not sure if we're still going to be able to use the standard VPX connector. We're certainly going to try, but there are other options that will come into play. But I think whatever we do, we're going to continue to work within OpenVPX to come up with a solution. So all of this is intended to continue to establish the longevity of VPX and OpenVPX and make sure that we can future-proof programs for our customers and really cement the legacy of OpenVPX for the future as well.
Excellent. Well, Ivan, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. So we recently were at the Embedded Tech Trends Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. So what was your favorite part about visiting the Big Easy?
I think I'd have to answer that question with two aspects. I think the most favorite part of New Orleans, two most favorite parts of New Orleans for me were the music and the food. We had a great host in John Ranovitz, our director of PR, did a lot of research and took us around to various areas, but the highlights were definitely the great jazz bands and Zydeco, which was a musical format I wasn't familiar with until visiting New Orleans, and I love now. And the food was just fantastic. It's really the Cajun and all the other flavors is just out of this world and was really delicious and enlightening at the same time.
I love it. I would agree on both of those points. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me, Ivan and Mike.
Thanks, Amelia.
You're welcome, Amelia.
Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, keyword EE Journal. It is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, which includes our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series. Yeah, hosted by yours truly. Okay. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Fryin' page, you can grab our Fish Fryin' RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Fryin' page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or heck, even the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of March 3rd, 2017, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.